This is Lover Alternative News. I'm Jim Burr. A dividing line opens up in Europe. Cancun, Mexico's seaside resort, where the ministerial summit of the World Trade Organization opens Wednesday, has become a political border dividing European governments from non-governmental organizations. European governments are warning that a collapse of the WTO summit would be a major setback for world economic affairs, but most non-governmental organizations, NGOs, working on issues such as economic cooperation, the environment, and human rights, think just the opposite. A failure at Cancun would be a good thing. The NGOs have been holding demonstrations across Europe for weeks now to say that the WTO summit will do nothing to improve environmental and social standards. NGOs, such as the Confederación Paysan, a farmers' union that supports organic farming, Greenpeace, Taxation of Financial Transactions for the Aid of Citizens, ATTAC after its French name, and the Public Servants Union, SUD, organized the first major demonstration in France, August 8th through 10th. Close to 100,000 people, farmers, teachers, students, intellectuals, and union members, came together to discuss the NGO agenda for Cancun. Leader of Confederation Paysan, José Bové, urged the French government to reject the treaties to be discussed at Cancun. One government can suspend the whole process, Bové said at a protest meeting. May the French government have the courage to do so. Bové, a veteran of Seattle and Genoa, will not be in Cancun because he faces a suspended prison sentence for destroying genetically modified plantations. Instead, he will follow the WTO summit at Concon, a small village in the southwest of France. At a meeting held last week, Jacques Nikonoff, president of ATTAC, also called for suspension of WTO negotiations until the effects of WTO decisions in Africa, Asian, and Latin America are determined. The WTO and the governments in Europe and North America pretend that free trade benefits the Third World, but historic evidence suggests the opposite, Nikonoff said. Other French activists accused European governments of taking a schizophrenic position towards the WTO. France is the home country to private water corporations such as Suez and Vivendi, which have been taking over water rights in Argentina, South Africa, and Indonesia, among other countries of the South, says Yannick Jadot, campaign director at Greenpeace France. But at the same time, French officials publicly speak of the WTO as a terrible instrument of the transformation of the world into a merchandise, Jadot told IPS. NGOs in Germany, Italy, and elsewhere in Europe have also been protesting against the WTO and called for collapse of negotiations at Cancun. Last Saturday, about 500 German NGOs gathered in Berlin to condemn the WTO as a non-democratic organization. The German NGOs particularly accused the WTO of trying to push genetically modified organisms into Europe and of failing to protect the agriculture of developing countries from subsidy-driven competition from richer industrialized nations. A second Seattle, a failure at the Cancun negotiations, wouldn't be a bad thing, Peter Wald from World Economy, Ecology and Development, WEED, told the Berlin meeting. Maybe then the richest countries in Europe and North America would understand that they can no longer fob off third world countries with peanuts. In Italy, anti-globalization protesters temporarily blocked access to Riva del Garda in the north, where European Union foreign ministers were to meet Friday. Luca Casarini, leader of Italy's so-called disobedient movement, said the roads were blocked to block the violence of liberalization policies. While NGOs, unions, and farmers' organizations have been condemning the WTO summit, officials and corporate representatives have been arguing that the success of the meeting is necessary for world prosperity. German Finance and Labor Minister Wolfgang Clement spelt out where Germany's interests lie in a statement last Saturday. Germany, as an export country, has an extraordinary interest that Cancun succeed, he said. A third of all workplaces in Germany depend on exports. Clement will be leading the German delegation to Cancun. The French government has avoided open praise of the WTO and the Cancun summit, but managers of private enterprises working closely with the government have been saying how crucial the meeting is to them. Success at Cancun is necessary to launch new negotiations on the protection of private investment, reduction of custom controls, and transparency in public biddings, Jacques Dupont, commissioner for the WTO at the Movement of French Enterprises and at the European Federation of Employers Organizations, said in a statement. Business lobbies are clearly pushing for inclusion of these new issues at the WTO. The NGOs seem to have the backing of most people. In an opinion poll published in Paris Monday, 72% of the people said third world countries will be losers in a process of economic globalization. Conference draws 2,000 NGOs from 83 countries. Mexico City. This week's World Trade Organization Ministerial Conference in the Mexican resort of Cancun will also serve as a showcase and podium for nearly 2,000 civil society organizations from 83 countries, whose members have been flowing in by the plane and busload. The protesters are part of the diverse international movement that is opposed to the current model of globalization. Around one-third of the non-governmental organizations present this week in Cancun come from Canada, the United States, and Mexico. One-third are from the European Union, and the rest are from Asia, Africa, and South America. Melba Priya, the Mexican government official in charge of relations with NGOs, told IPS. Cancun will be a showcase for gauging the weight of the NGOs and finding out if the governments of industrialized countries and corporations are willing to listen to them and accept some of their proposals, Adam Jones, with the Political Studies Department at the Mexican Center for Economic Research and Teaching, said in an interview. The fifth WTO Ministerial Conference, which will run Wednesday through Sunday in the resort city of Cancun in southeastern Mexico, is crucial to the future of the current round of multilateral trade talks launched at the last WTO meeting, held in 2001 in Doha, Qatar, that is to be concluded by January 1, 2005. The talks have reached an impasse over many issues, due mainly to discrepancies between rich countries and the developing world, which already turned the third ministerial conference held in December 1999 in the U.S. city of Seattle, Washington, into a fiasco. The meeting in Seattle, which ended without an agreement to start a new round of talks, was marked by major clashes between activists and police, and is regarded by many as the starting point for the anti-globalization movement. But social researchers underline that what happened in Seattle was only the most visible expression of the movement up to that point, and that the groups opposed to globalization in its current shape and form have been holding protests since the early 1990s. One of the first mobilizations of the so-called anti-globalization movement was the anti-APEC, Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, International Day of Protest, held in November 1996 in the Philippines. The NGOs complain that the WTO is dominated by the governments of the industrialized world and large corporations, a situation that they say translates into policies that act against poor countries. While some of the groups are demanding the democratization of the WTO and a shift in direction for the international bodies, others want it to be dismantled. Taking part in the protests this week will be delegates of a broad range of NGOs, from groups that have consultative status with the United Nations, such as the Association of World Citizens, an international peace organization with branches in 50 countries, to radical groups known for their violent tactics, such as Italy's Toute Bianche. Of the roughly 2,000 organizations that will be present, 980 are accredited with the WTO to officially participate in the ministerial conference. Of the accredited groups, 30% are organizations of farmers and campesinos, 20% are environmental organizations, and 20% are groups that focus on issues like globalization, gender, human rights, and trade. Some 300 business associations are also taking part, but activists complain that they merely represent the interests of transnational corporations. The WTO and Mexican government turned down requests for accreditation from at least another 200 civil society groups, arguing that their focus and activities had nothing to do with the issues to be discussed at the conference. The representatives of the 980 participating NGOs will share the Caribbean resort's elegant hotels and take part in the meetings with the ministers and officials of multilateral bodies in the resort area of Cancun. In the meantime, the delegates of around 1,000 civil society organizations, mainly rural, indigenous, labor and women's groups, as well as hundreds of independent activists, will be camped out in parks, theaters, and sports clubs, 10 kilometers away in the city of Cancun itself. The NGOs that received accreditation from the WTO conference will be allowed to attend the ministerial debates. They will also be able to broadcast their proposals and suggestions free of charge on a special TV channel that will function during the conference and to post documents on the WTO website. By contrast, the Mexican government will not allow the organizations attending the parallel People's Forum for Alternatives to the WTO to approach the convention center, where the trade ministers from the WTO's 146 member countries will be meeting. If the participants in the People's Forum or protesters attempt to press past special checkpoints set up along the only road leading to the conference site, they will face more than 1,000 police officers with strict orders to keep them out. Alejandro Calvillo, director of Greenpeace Mexico, one of the groups that will be taking part in the ministerial conference, told IPS that the NGOs are not interested in using violence, despite what some governments want people to believe. On the contrary, what we are seeking is dialogue to set forth proposals that have long been taking shape, he said. When clashes occur due to the attitude of some police or to a strategy of provocation by a tiny minority of activists, enormous damage is caused to organized civil society, he said. students from the National Autonomous University of Mexico, who have admitted to having ties with Tout Vianche, announced that they would equip themselves with helmets, protective padding for arms and legs, and baseball bats to confront the police and clear a way through the cordon for groups that want to reach the conference site. Alvaro Lopez, with Mexico's National Union of Agricultural Workers, said that members of his group and others would march towards the meeting area, and we do not rule out the possibility of blood being shed. This week, more than 30,000 people from every region and continent will be protesting globalization in its current shape and form in Cancun and will push for the failure of the WTO meeting, said Hector de la Cueva, spokesman for the Mexican Network of Action Against Free Trade. Among the Mexican NGOs coordinating the protests and other events to take place in the streets and squares of Cancun, whose representatives have been in the city for over a month, differences have arisen in the past few days with respect to what format the protest should take. I believe the majority of the civil society organizations do not want to derail the meeting, but would like to push the WTO onto a more equitable track to ensure a globalization process that is closer to the people, said Priya, the Mexican government official. Spokespersons for conservative Mexican President Vicente Fox say freedom of speech is guaranteed in Cancun, but warn that any attempt to shut down the conference will be blocked. Jones, at the Mexican Center for Economic Research and Teaching, said most of the activists reject violence. But, he added, if the clashes with police had not taken place in Seattle and at later international meetings, the governments would not have felt the pressure and urgent need to listen to these groups. The majority of the NGOs describe themselves as peaceful and share the common denominator of questioning the present model of globalization, despite the fact that the tools the activists have used to make their movement an international one, such as the Internet, emerged from the globalization process itself. In the past 30 years, civil society has gone from being a mere concept to an organized movement with enormous influence around the world, Jones noted. Many of the groups present this week in Cancun have also regularly taken part in the World Social Forum, which has drawn critics of the current globalization model to the southern Brazilian city of Porto Alegre in January or February over the past 3 years to discuss alternatives to unfederal neoliberal capitalism. In the constellation of NGOs, there are all kinds of interests and strategies, but the ones that draw the most attention from the media are certain violent groups which discredit the movement, said Jones. World's poor take on the West. Crucial global trade talks open in the luxury holiday resort of Cancun today, with 146 countries squaring up for a bruising 5 days of negotiations amid little expectation that much headway will be made to bridge yawning gaps between rich and poor. With security at an almost paranoid level, a third Mexican warship anchored off the Caribbean beach yesterday. The two big power blocks, the EU and the US, were playing their negotiating cards close to their chest. But there was a new militancy among developing countries, led by China, Brazil, and India, which are determined not to be bulldozed in the horse trading. Last night, the town was brought to a halt by a march of about 1,000 peasant farmers, indigenous peoples, and students who were stopped at the entrance of the luxury hotel zone by thousands of police. No arrests or violence were reported. Whereas previous trade rounds have been stitched up by the EU, the US, and Japan, poor countries have roundly rejected a last-minute deal on agriculture from Washington and Brussels as inadequate. Instead, a coalition of developing countries, representing 60% of the world's farmers, has tabled its own far more ambitious proposal, which would substantially cut Western farm subsidies, currently worth 6 times more than all global aid spending. An alliance of charities and developing world groups yesterday demanded that these subsidies should be reduced and that further liberalization of the world economy should be stopped. The failure of developing countries to honor their commitments to development round calls into question the credibility of the WTO, a spokesman for ActionAid said. The Trade Secretary, Patricia Hewitt, arrives later this week to lead the British negotiating team, but the Environment Secretary, Margaret Beckett, already here, was optimistic yesterday. There are a lot of delicate and difficult negotiations ahead, she said. Most people do not want these talks to fail. That would be disastrous for the international economy. Nevertheless, delegates have been at each other's throats in the weeks leading up to the meeting on everything from farm subsidies to intellectual property rights. A largely symbolic deal on cheap drugs for the developing world is all there is to show for 2 years of haggling since the new round of talks was launched in Doha, Qatar, in November 2001. There, developing world countries were promised that if they agreed to participate in the new round, the West would phase out export subsidies, which experts blame for the mountains of cheap food dumped each year in poor countries, bankrupting local farmers. The EU and the US also promised to open their markets to poor country agricultural exports and to trim the most trade-distorting subsidies which keep their inefficient farmers in business. 2 years after Doha, it is clear that the EU would prefer cosmetic to radical surgery. Having botched the reform of its common agricultural policy, Brussels has taken to denouncing developing countries for demanding what was promised at Doha. Washington blew its credentials as the champion of farm reform when the Bush administration signed a farm bill giving U.S. farmers an extra $80 billion in subsidies over the next 10 years. Trade experts say that without a deal on agriculture, the negotiations could stall in Cancun, making it even less likely that they will end on schedule by January 1, 2005. There are two requirements for a successful outcome, said Kevin Watkins of Oxfam. First, industrialized countries need to agree to a clear and short time frame for eliminating export subsidies. Second, they need to cut the production subsidies that generate surpluses and facilitate export dumping. The most contentious area is the EU's demand for global foreign investment and competition rules. Developing countries fear this can prevent them imposing stringent regulations on foreign multinationals. Led by India, half the WTO's developing country members have signaled that they are unhappy about the talks. Investment is the issue most likely to cause a bust-up in the EU caucus. Britain, once the most fervent supporter, is backpedaling furiously. If Pascal Lamy, Europe's senior negotiator, insists on forcing the issue, he could face a rebellion in his own caucus room. Privately, ministers hint that the round is unlikely to end on time. Drivers to be rated for risk level. The new system will scrutinize each passenger, assign color code. In the most aggressive, and some say invasive step yet to protect air travelers, the federal government and the airlines will phase in a computer system next year to measure the risk posed by every passenger on every flight in the United States. The new Transportation Security Administration system seeks to probe deeper into each passenger's identity than is currently possible, comparing personal information against criminal records and intelligence information. Passengers will be assigned a color code, green, yellow, or red, based in part on their city of departure, destination, traveling companions, and date of ticket purchase. Most people will be coded green and sail through, but up to 8% of passengers who board the nation's 26,000 daily flights will be coded yellow and will undergo additional screening at the checkpoint, according to people familiar with the program. An estimated 1 to 2% will be labeled red and will be prohibited from boarding. These passengers also will face police questioning and may be arrested. The system will provide protections for the flying public, said TSA spokesman Brian Turmail. Not only should we keep passengers from sitting next to a terrorist, we should keep them from sitting next to wanted axe murderers. The new system, called Computer-Assisted Passenger Pre-Screening System 2, CAPS 2, has sparked so much controversy among both liberal and conservative groups that the TSA has struggled to get it going. Delta Airlines backed out of a testing program with the agency earlier this year. And now the TSA will not reveal which airlines will participate when it tests a prototype early next year. If all goes as planned, the TSA will begin the new computer screening of some passengers as early as next summer, and eventually it will be used for all domestic travelers. The system is going to be replete with errors, says Barry Steinhardt, director of the American Civil Liberties Union's Technology and Liberty Program. You could be falsely arrested. You could be delayed. You could lose your ability to travel. In the 2 years since the September 11, 2001 terrorist hijackings, air security has taken a high priority, and the government has spent $9 billion on improvements. Thousands of explosives detection machines now scan checked luggage at airports across the nation. A new force of federal airport screeners staffs checkpoints, though next year some airports may revert to private screeners. Cockpit doors have been reinforced, and hundreds of airline pilots now carry guns. In addition, the force of undercover air marshals has been expanded, and as many as 5,000 federal immigration and customs agents will be trained to bolster the force on a temporary basis when the government perceives a heightened threat. Still, many holes in security persist. Airports and aircraft still appear easy to penetrate, illustrated last month by an accidental landing of several boaters on the airfield at John F. Kennedy International Airport. Air cargo remains vulnerable, as virtually none of the items stowed alongside luggage in the aircraft hold are screened for explosives. Government officials continue to assess how best to respond to the possibility of a shoulder-fired missile attack at a commercial airliner, which they maintain is a serious threat. In the coming months, major airports in Los Angeles, Seattle, Denver, and Dallas will embark on extensive construction projects to build explosives detection machines into conveyor belt systems that sort checked luggage being loaded onto planes. Other airports, including Washington's, are waiting in line for hundreds of millions of dollars in government funding. Clearly, the TSA says, the job of protecting the nation's skies is not done. Given the dynamic nature of the threat we deal with, it would be impossible to predict when the work would be finished on air security, said TSA spokesman Robert Johnson. we don't think it will ever end. The government says the most significant change in security is still to come in the form of CAPS II. The current computer screener program was developed by U.S. Airlines in the mid-1990s in response to government and public pressure to improve air security after terrorists blew up Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. The existing system identifies certain passengers as risky based on a set of assumptions about how terrorists travel. For instance, passengers are flagged for additional screening if they bought a one-way airline ticket or if they paid with cash instead of a credit card. Passengers who present a threat under these and other criteria are issued boarding passes that bear a coding of SSS, or 3*. But the TSA, recognizing that the system is outdated and easy to fool, wants to replace it and put the government in the role now played by the airlines in making security assessments. From bad to worse. Following are the Senate floor remarks delivered by Robert Byrd on September 5, 2003. Bush addressed the nation on September 7th and expressed his intention to request that Congress grant an additional $87 billion in military and reconstruction spending for next year, significantly more than the range White House officials had given lawmakers, between $60 billion and $70 billion. Mr. President, after a dismal summer of watching the situation in Iraq spiral from bad to worse, the White House appears to have finally acknowledged what many of us have understood from the beginning. It is going to take huge amounts of money, a long-term commitment, and substantial help from the international community to restore order to Iraq. After stiff-arming the United Nations over its refusal to rubber-stamp the administration's war plans for Iraq, and alienating some of our staunchest allies in the process, the White House has finally acquiesced to seeking a new resolution that potentially would give the United Nations the vital role in post-war Iraq that the President once pledged. I only hope this change of heart is not a lesson too late for the learning. The United States has squandered on Iraq so much of the international goodwill that followed the September 11th terrorist attacks that it may be impossible to regain all the ground that has been lost. It is particularly ironic that the administration's decision to seek a new resolution to win international support from the United Nations comes almost exactly 1 year after the President sternly warned that body that it faced becoming irrelevant if it failed to support the United States in Iraq. How far off the mark that assessment turned out to be. Instead of being irrelevant, the United Nations has emerged as America's best and possibly only hope to win desperately needed international support for the post-war mission in Iraq. It is equally ironic that the administration is seeking an estimated $60 billion to $70 billion in additional funding for Iraq from the American taxpayers, at a time when the Senate is debating adding a fraction of that amount to an appropriations bill to provide critical funding, funding the President himself pledged to provide in his No Child Left Behind initiative for school children in poor school districts. Earlier this week, I offered an amendment to the Labor, Health, and Human Services and Education Appropriations Bill that would add $6.1 billion for Title I education programs to fully fund the money Congress authorized for fiscal year 2004 in the No Child Left Behind Act. This is money that Congress promised to provide, and it is money that our schools desperately need. Unfortunately, I fear I am fighting an uphill battle to win passage of my amendment. Opponents of the amendment have already staked out their positions, complaining that we can't afford the additional funding, that the amendment will add $6 billion to the deficit, and that we are already doing plenty for education. I don't buy any of those arguments, and I wonder how the senators who object to the cost of my amendment will view the President's request to add $60 billion or $65 billion or $70 billion to the deficit to fund military and reconstruction activities in Iraq. I wonder if they will be comfortable voting to support a massive spending program for Iraq if they cannot bring themselves to support a comparatively meager increase in education funding for American school children. Mr. President, I intend to speak at greater length on my education amendment at a later time, but I urge my colleagues to begin reflecting on what kind of signal we will be sending to American families if we shortchange education funding by $6 billion one day and approve 10 times that amount for Iraq the next. And make no mistake about it, Congress has little choice but to provide some level of additional funding for military and reconstruction activities in Iraq. We bulldozed our way into that country almost single-handedly over the objections of most of the international community, and now we are paying the price for our arrogance. With the exception of the help we have received from the British government, we've gotten almost no monetary assistance and precious little military assistance from other nations to assist with our operations in Iraq. We have, perhaps, a chance to mend fences and garner more support from the United Nations if the administration can swallow its pride and come up with a new resolution that cedes a meaningful role in the reconstruction of Iraq to the international community. Perhaps we also have a chance to attract serious monetary contributions from the international community. But I doubt that we will begin to approach the level of support that we received from other nations during the first Gulf War. Nevertheless, we must keep trying, and returning to the United Nations is as important, if long overdue, first step. The American taxpayer should not have to shoulder the entire burden of restoring order and rebuilding Iraq. Moreover, Congress and the American people must insist on a full accounting from the administration of the dollars it is requesting for Iraq. The fact that we are faced with staggering demands in Iraq does not mean that Congress should feel compelled to hand the administration a blank check. A lack of careful planning on the part of the administration for post-war Iraq helped get us into our current difficulties, and we cannot afford to repeat our mistakes. Just 5 months ago, Congress provided $78.5 billion in funds for military and reconstruction activities in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now we are learning that we will need far more money for Iraq far sooner than the administration either anticipated or admitted. We need to demand the details before we approve any more money for Iraq. We should require the President to submit a detailed budget request for the $60 billion to $70 billion he is seeking in supplemental funding for Iraq, and the Appropriations Committee should hold hearings on that request. We could not get straight answers from the administration on the expected cost or duration of the Iraq operations the first time around. We cannot afford to settle for evasions this time around. The supplemental funding request that the President is expected to send to Congress in the next few weeks gives us an opportunity to demand answers to some of the most pressing questions involving our occupation of Iraq. What is our post-war strategy for Iraq? What are we doing to improve the security situation in Baghdad and other key cities? What have we accomplished in terms of restoring electricity, drinking water, and other basic services to Iraqi citizens? What kind of timetable are we facing? Do we have any kind of exit strategy? Who is making the decisions? By far, the greatest monetary cost in Iraq is the cost of the military occupation. Of the $60 billion to $70 billion the President is expected to request, all but $10 billion or so is earmarked for the Defense Department. The current cost of military operations in Iraq is $3.9 billion a month. With massive federal budget deficits staring us in the face, how long can we sustain that level of spending in Iraq? Do we have any realistic expectation that other countries will help to offset that cost, even if we manage to get another UN resolution? Who is going to help us in Iraq, and how will they help us? These are extremely important questions, and Congress and the American people need to know the answers before committing even more resources to Iraq. Congress should put the White House on notice now that it will require a full explanation and a rigorous justification of the budget request before voting on it. In the meantime, Congress has other pressing matters on its plate. Next week, the Senate will consider whether to fully fund a critical education program for our neediest school children. I hope that we will treat that issue and my amendment with the same sense of urgency and importance that the President expects us to treat the supplemental budget request for Iraq. There is no issue more important to the future of our country than the education of our children. On this issue especially, I hope that the Senate will put aside any hint of partisanship and vote to fully fund the No Child Left Behind Act. This has been Lover Alternative News. For an archive of the week's news shows, go to http://www.luver.org. There you will also find more news stories, a list of other alternative news sites, etc.